This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I'm doing a special interview with Carmen Jimenez-Smith. She's the editor of Puerto del Sol, a literary magazine based at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. And Carmen is also the co-founder and editor of Noemi Press, also located in Las Cruces. This interview was recorded live at Woodland Pattern Book Center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in October 2015. It's a continuation of a series of conversations I've been having with literary magazine and independent press editors and publishers trying to document publishing over the last 50 years.
I do a podcast called Writer's Cast. I started doing this in 2008. I recorded interviews with writers of all different kinds, and I still do. But a couple of years ago, I decided to start talking to publishers and editors and technology people about the future and the kind of prospect of publishing. And I called that Publishing Talks. Within the Writer's Cast podcast. It's like an alternative channel. And then I realized that I knew a lot of people who were editors and publishers of literary magazines that I'd been involved with for years and years, and that no one had actually talked to about what they'd been doing for the last 40 or 50 years. And I realized that there were some people in that community who were passing away, and I didn't want to lose their memories before they disappeared. A lot of poets and writers I know have passed that I didn't get a chance to talk to for posterity. So I've started recording interviews with people like John Martin from Black Sparrow Press and Alan Kornblum from Coffee House, which unfortunately, I mean, I did talk to him prior to him passing away, but Brad Morrow from Conjunctions and a lot of people that I knew from years ago and who I thought had something to say about publishing and the literary arts that we care about. So this is going to be a continuation for me of that, but a new thing because I've never done it publicly before. I've never talked to a publisher in front of an audience. So it'll be interesting to see how that's different, how the circumstance may alter the conversation. But mainly what I'm here to do is to enable Carmen to talk about her work. So this is Carmen Jimenez-Smith. She's the editor, and I think everyone in this room knows, but the audience that may be listening in does not know that she's an editor of Noemi Press and Puerto del Sol, a literary magazine, both of which are based in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where she lives and teaches. And Puerto del Sol, which I think we should talk about first, because it is one of the longest-running literary magazines. I don't know whether anybody keeps track of these things. I'm sure somebody does. But
we just had our 50th anniversary.
Yeah. And it's twice a year, has always been.
Yeah.
So that's 100 issues, mm-hmm. which is a major accomplishment. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, I'm curious about the history, you know, without going into vast detail, but, you know, what was the founding mission of Puerto del Sol, and how is that either the same or different today?
I think when it was published in the 70s, it was primarily publishing students and local people. And I think that as the faculty changed, they started doing more regional stuff and local stuff, state New Mexico stuff. I think when when Kevin McElvoy, who was the editor for 20 years before me, I think when he got there, he had a very specific vision of a journal that would feature emerging writers and really serve emerging writers and the students who were editing the magazine. So when I first started teaching at NMSU in 2002, the students would write handwritten notes to every person. And, you know, that was a very important part of Mac's sense of community and responsibility. And a lot of really amazing writers had early short stories come out and poems too in Puerto del Sol. One of them is David Foster Wallace. He had a very short story way back when. For this 50th issue, we went through the archives and we looked at all the people that had been published in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s to see like what famous people were, and there were tons. And so then we invited them to submit something new, and we had a little feature in which they described, you know, what it was like. And for a lot of them, it was like their first publication or their second publication. They were so thrilled. It was so exciting for them. And it was, you know, an important stepping stone for them to like have confidence and feel good about what they were doing. So that's how it started, based on what I know.
So some oral history.
Some oral history. And Mac did such a fantastic job for so many years of just making sure that there was a beautiful balance, a beautiful aesthetic balance, and a beautiful balance between established and emerging writers. And so when he retired, I became the editor. You know, I wanted to, those are big shoes to fill. But I did want to preserve that energy of featuring emerging writers. But I also thought that it was important just for the health of the magazine to have, you know, a lot of established, not a lot of established writers, but more established writers, about, you know, a little bit more than emerging writers. We shifted. So we started querying people, which was new to Puerto's, you know, ethos. But the reason I liked doing that was that it gave students a chance to speak to their heroes, right? Like they could, dear whoever, I am an editor, you know, it gives them a connection to someone and, you know, potentially a relationship. And so that was one aspect of how Evan, my husband, and I sort of worked on it together at the beginning. We changed the design format of it, and part of the other problem we had was that we lost distribution. Most literary magazines lost distribution. They were all dropped by the distributors, college magazines, unless they were really, really wildly successful. So we had to make it something that people would want. You know, they're not just going to buy it as impulse at a bookstore, but they're going to be like, I want the next issue of Puerto del Sol. So we tried to be flashy. We changed the design. And then this year we're moving to half online and half print because everything happens online. And the students are, they keep a blog and they're writing reviews for the blog, and they're also soliciting work. And the next issue, the online issue, is coming out pretty soon. So we're excited.
That's a perfect lead in because you described some of the challenges that literary magazines face in the current time. And it's also, every challenge is also an opportunity, but it is different to think of magazines as available for viewing in a place like Woodland Pattern or a bookstore. And of course, there aren't that many stores or places that would carry them.
That's
so
right.
That's why distribution doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But it is, I think there is a palpable difference between reading a physical object, a book or a magazine, and online reading.
Yeah,
you know, it changes the relationship between the reader and the work. And so, so are you committed to kind of continuing to do both?
Yes, because I think the skill set that students learn of having to produce a print journal is very useful. It's a process, and it's a process that exposes them to something that hopefully is going to be the experience they have when they're publishing their first books. They learn a lot about production, about design, about order, and all of that. And you can't teach, like, there's no order in an online thing, but there's, you know, there's order in a journal. And so they spend a lot of time thinking about what pieces are going to go. They have one meeting that's all about what is going to go first, what's going to follow it, how are they speaking to each other. So actually, like, our issues are cohesive in that way, that it's very thoughtful in how they're connected. And I think that prepares them for also organizing their books as well.
And so do you think that the online version, you'll explore the way that digital publishing enables a collection and exposure to something that's different from print, but also has, I mean, this is a word that I've seen used often in digital publishing, the affordances of digital. There are things that digital allows that print does not.
Yeah.
The structure is different. And there are things that print does that digital can't do. So it seems like you have the opportunity, especially since it's a teaching environment, to explore how digital publishing can be valuable and not just putting it out. You know, whatever it comes to your mind, you put it up.
Yeah. I think the negotiation is online, more audience, right? But print has, you know, it's print. I mean, we still sort of venerate the experience of the print journal. And the decisions we had to make about like what goes into the print journal and what goes into the online, especially with fiction, had to do with length. Like really long pieces just don't work online. Unless they're printable, but then you might as well just put them in right. the
Now,
in
when
the
you say they don't work online, do you mean because the reading experience
Yeah. I think that people right. just generally have trouble reading longer works online.
And so when you publish it online, it will be on the web. It's not you're doing essentially book in browser. You're not going to try to use a digital reading platform.
No, it's going to be,
It'll
yeah.
just be online.
That's right. We do have a digital reading platform. I can't remember. It's a very small, like ebook. They do like Fairy Tale Review. I don't remember their name, but we do the paper issues are also available like an EPUB. But this will be online. And I think the other part of it that the reason that we're also bringing it online is that it connects the students to a really active conversation. That's taken place online as curators and as participants. And the blog that they do that goes with it is a big part of it. They're reviewing tons of books. They're thinking about writing. They're thinking about what it means to be a graduate student. And they're using that space to talk about it. So those two things in tandem, I think, creates a more cohesive, sense of what Puerto del Sol is in this moment. Because our staff changes every year. We have graduate right. students coming in and out, and their interests change, who they are, you know, what they want, what they like. That all changes. And I've always felt like to give them all, because they're doing all the work, they make all the decisions. I mean, I'm sort of like, you know, if it's a bad, bad choice. But they've never really made a bad choice. But if there were a really bad choice, I would cut it. They haven't done that yet. They're really smart and thoughtful, and then the people that they bring in and the kinds of issues that we produce has so much more to do with the moment, because they have a lot of agency and they know who like the hot writers are and all of that good stuff. And I'm just kind of, you know, the den mother.
No, I think that's it. In a certain
way. I have
way.
Bail money that for them.
I think editors are, in fact. You know, in a certain way, enablers.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you're trying to do. Do you feel like what was the response of the writers that you reached out to for the 50th issue in terms of ongoing involvement? Did that sort of remind them that Puerto del Sol was there, that maybe they'd forgotten about it and or were not part of its community anymore?
Yeah, I think a few people were very moved to think about those first publications and to read them. Some of them hadn't even thought of some of those publications in a long time. And so to revisit that experience, that thrill of, yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're going to give us money, but they were very excited.
Well, they're writers.
Yeah, exactly. They don't have any.
Right.
But it was, I think, it was also special for students to see how a writing career evolves, to see an early piece of writing. And that was sort of another part of the idea, was to see this is what Leslie Marmon Silka wrote in the 70s versus what she's writing now.
Yeah.
Right. And that shows like that there's a big, people change, people evolve. Leslie Marmon Silka wasn't born whole, you know, writing amazing novels. She was learning things at a certain point. And I think Puerto del Sol has been a really good record of those, of really good early work by exciting writers.
Well, I was going to ask you, and you've given me a great lead in the role of the literary magazine. I think people forget, you know, that there's, that the literary magazine has this incredible, meaningfulness to writers who are at the earlier stage, and maybe later too, but particularly for when you're starting out, it gives you a place to be not only be read, but also to that responds to you. You know, that editors of literary magazines are more likely to have conversations with the writers that are submitting than, let's say, an editor of a large publishing house.
That's right. And they also copy edit the work. So they're learning what that process is like, how to refine it, a work so it's ready to be published, which is different from refining something to send out.
Right. Well, you learn the entire process. Students involved in the magazine are learning.
Yes.
But also, I think that there's this, you know, for the writers themselves, it's a kind of an important part of the ecosystem of publishing that, you know, I think sometimes in the larger publishing world is neglected. You know, they used to call them the little magazines. You know, there's always that diminutive, the small press, the little magazines. Somehow that is, you know, insulting.
Yeah.
You know, these are the magazines, as you know, that you're like Puerto del Sol and many others are the first places where some of the great writers of America ever published.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important because that means today you have your publishing people today who may 30 or 40 years from now be looked at as, you know, the really most important writers of their time.
That's right. Yeah.
So, do your students go back into the archives and regularly look at what was done in the past?
So now they are, and we're slowly bringing more archival material online because it's such a rich, we have such a rich archive.
We have 100 issues.
We have 100 issues of amazing work by amazing writers. And so we're bringing it slowly online. I do think, I haven't checked because I'm not, and my husband's running it right now. I do think that all of this stuff that was in the 50th issue, the original writings of those people are available online. And then we're kind of looking through it and finding other things that they think is onlineable, I guess you would say.
Right. Well, and probably, you know, when most of us think about taking a magazine or the archives of a magazine and making it available online, not such a trivial task.
No.
I mean, it's a lot of work to do this.
So
I assume this will take you a long time.
It's going to take a long time. But they're into it. They're excited. I mean, it's like hunting and they're reading stuff and they're reading a lot and getting excited. The whole process of figuring out who was going to be in the 50th issue was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to revisit, you know, these names, read them, think about like, wow, this was, you know, what was going on. It was fun to look at the way that the design evolved of the magazine from like the, you know, with the 70s with the long girl with the long hair on the cover to, you know, like then there was like the early 80s with like very Southwest-y kind of look.
So what is your design ethos today? How would you define it?
So we did a redesign. Evan and I did a redesign of the magazine when we got it. We thought it was great as it was, but we wanted to make it ours. And so we made it square, kind of like a fence size magazine. And they're not as big. We just don't do those massive, like there used to be Puerto del Sol that were like 600 pages that were insane. And we did just, we paid more attention to the graphic design of the page. I think that before the magazine was typeset by students, which I think was great in terms of getting them experienced, and we're going to move back in that direction. But visually, it just wasn't using the page in an exciting, interesting way. And so we hired someone to do a redesign for the interior. Evan designed the logo. And then we decided that we would feature visual art on the cover and often in the inside of the magazine. Because the other change we made was going to digital printing. Before, when Kevin McElvoy was doing it, it was offset, which is, you know, enormously expensive. But since the terms like the distribution and stuff had changed, we couldn't print 500 or 1,000. We weren't going to sell 500 or 1,000. So we did small batches to print, and that's worked out really well for us.
So you can, with digital printing, of course, you can always print more.
Yeah, exactly. So if we run out, just say we need 101.
So what's
more.
Your starting number of copies?
I think it's like 150 to 250. It depends. you know, that's usually how many we do.
So you have a lot of, do libraries subscribe and?
Libraries subscribe, people buy them. We sell a lot of them online. We just started, so again, when I took over, we got a website and we started selling them online. And we sell, you know, a lot of it is like somebody's mom, you know, like buying issues, but that's fine. I don't care who buys them.
Right.
But the place where I think the new iteration of Puerto del Sol has been seen has been at AWP. Like people will be like, oh my gosh, I remember when it looked like this, or I was in it once upon a time, or I don't know what this is. And so that's been exciting. People thinking about Puerto del Sol of a place that they want to submit or they want to be published in. Because it's, you know, it's a pretty magazine. I like it.
Well, it's a visually very appealing magazine. You've done a nice job with that.
Thank you.
And, you know, it is hard to get people to buy literary magazines out there. You should be buying literary magazines on a regular basis. But today, you know, it used to be you actually could go to a bookstore and spend a lot of time looking at literary magazines. And I know also from many years of experience that a lot of people would treat the bookstore as a library and read it in the store, thumb through, because when you'd get it back, it would be clearly, you know, coffee stained, thumbprints, everything. You knew people, but people were reading it.
That's right.
And you don't have that opportunity now. So maybe the online presentation substitutes for in-person browsing. I think that may be where we're headed.
And I think that it just, you get more readers online than you do in print journals. I mean, unless you're a Public Space or Paris Review or Poetry Magazine, you know, there just aren't that many people buying. It's not easy to do it, first of all, and then there people aren't doing it. If it's free, you know, why pay for
That's
it?
That's true. And there is a great deal of free stuff
to
be found. But, you know, somebody has to pay for the future.
That's right.
And that's who we are. Mm-hmm. So let's switch now from Puerto del Sol to your other empire. Which is Noemi Press. Now, Noemi was founded by you and your husband, Evan.
Well, it was founded by me, and then I met my husband 6 months later. Yeah. So he got suckered into
you're right.
it.
He's Johnny come lately.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
He had to come in.
He didn't have a choice.
Right. So, and were you in Las Cruces when you started the press?
No, I lived in Oakland, and so I lived around the street from New College. And they had this store and it was just chapbooks. And I was in my late 20s, early 30s. And I'd never seen a place like that. And so I just immediately fell in love with like print culture and books and handmade books. And I had a couple of friends who were poets and they got a letterpress machine. And I was like, I know, I'll start a press and use their letterpress machine, which is basically what happened. I wanted to do it. I just wanted to see what it would be like. And, you know, I tricked everyone to help me do it. And that's basically how it went. I asked someone to help me. I had a friend, he worked in a corporation. I had him photocopy the interior so I wouldn't have to pay for the copies. It was just completely, you know, flying by the seat of my pants. And then Evan is much more organized and can, you know, he's smart and organized. I don't know what the hell else to say it. I'm not. I am smart, but not organized. And so when we got together, you know, we kept making the little books. We made chapbook. We made one with Ricky Ducournay, who did drawings. That went to Joanna Howard. That's a beautiful book. But then we had two kids, and it was just impossible. Like, you know, to be like every AWP, like at 5 o'clock in the morning before AWP, we're like stapling. And it's like, no, we can't do this anymore. And we also thought that that a full length book does more for a poet than a chapbook. And so we decided that we wanted to do full length books. And that was a big decision for us. And I never would have thought that we would still be doing it now and that we would be doing as many books as we do now. But
So when, what was, you started in 2002. So what was the time you decided to move to bigger books?
Like 2007 or 2008, and I think we did a call. I'm not exactly sure, but I think we did a call around 2008, and I think Claire Hero's Sing Mongrel was the first book we did, and that came, I'm pretty sure it came out in 2009. And then from then on, I mean, I don't remember, you know, what books we did after that. But the other interesting part of that was we used to do an open call and we'd just get like 30 manuscripts. And I spoke to another publisher, and she said that she had a similar problem, but then when she created a contest, they had hundreds of submissions. And so we started the contest, and it was also because we were going into like major credit card debt doing this. And, you know, we had to stop, we had to stop with that. And so we did the contest, and for a long time it was just Evan and me doing a lot of it. And then Evan was like, I'm out of here. He had to work on a novel. And so I was doing it. And then at a certain point I was like, I can't do this. And it was like, I felt guilty. I was like, I'm going to stop doing it. But then I was like, then all these books are going to be out of print. And then I, again, swindled some people into helping me for free. And so our staff is just, it's really big and people are really invested. And again, in a similar way with Puerto, I choose some books, like if I want to do a book, but they choose all the contest winners. If they want to propose a book, they can propose a book. You know, everyone has a stake in it, an editorial stake in it, because that's, you know, that's what they're not getting paid. That's a way to, but it also, I think, has made Noemi Press very rich, because it's not lockstep aesthetic, where there's no like identifiable aesthetic. When I first started in 2002 thinking about Noemi Press, I knew that I wanted it to be a press that published writers of color, but I didn't want it to be a press that was known just for publishing. I didn't want it to be a racialized press. And so I think that over many years, we were able to create a robust press in which it just happens we publish a lot of writers of color. And to me, that's the greatest success of Noemi Press, is that we're not seen as like, you know, that's the press that publishes Black people, or that's the press that publishes Asian people. It's Noemi Press, and they publish all kinds of people, and they publish a lot of people of color, you know. And so that's really very satisfying for me.
Are the people that you described as your kind of, your volunteers, are they also graduate students, or are they from all over the place, or are they all in the place where you live?
Right now, I have like 4 graduate students working on it at NMSU. J. Michael Martinez is one poetry editor. He's written a couple of books, and he's a great editor. Diana Artarian, we have a graduate student at Notre Dame named Susie Garcia. She just became a poetry editor. It's all over the map. It's all over the map. And that also, I think those sort of regional and academic settings that bring different aesthetics and different concerns to the table have all also created a very rich texture to what we choose.
So in that way, in some ways, that's different, I think, than some what we would think of as traditional literary publishers who are in a place, you know, and of that place sometimes, maybe of part of a writing community, part of a scene, a literary scene. You know, I think of San Francisco or Minneapolis, St. Paul, and, you know, that's a tradition, you know, that, but also what's another thing that's different about what you've done is you've structured your publishing as a nonprofit. And at what stage did you decide to do that? Because that's a big decision. It's going from being kind of a passion and informal to being structured and more formal. Now you have to file with the IRS every year.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big deal. So when did you decide to do that?
I think when we decided we were going to do full-length books, and although we knew that the overhead would be low, and when we started, Evan was designing all the books. Now we have lots of, you know, he designed Suzanne Scanlon's cover, but he's not designing. But that made it, again, cheaper. Whoever would do something for free for us, we would do, you know, like that's basically how we started. But then we realized, like, that's not a sustainable model, you know, because Evan is not going to design every book that we do. And so we thought, well, we want to be able to apply for funding, you know, and we want these different things. And so we did it. We just applied for the nonprofit status. I don't know that we've taken advantage of it as much as we can. We're just going to be starting to apply for grant, like an NEA grant. This is going to be the first year we apply for an NEA grant. I don't know how we do so many books because we don't have that much money, but digital printing is a big part of it, that we're able to do small batches. But the problem now that we're facing is that our books are selling pretty well, and so we have to do bigger batches. And so that's like
It's almost like a trap,
yeah. But it makes us happy. It's a good trap. It makes us happy, and the writers are happy with the attention their books get. With several of our books, we created study guides, so you know they're accessible not only to you know someone who's a poetry reader, but it's useful for someone who might want to teach the book in a class. And that's also our hope is also that we're making poetry more accessible to people.
That's another. You gave me a good lead into my question, which is about distribution. You know, the distribution and selling of poetry has always been difficult, but today probably more difficult.
Yeah.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about how do you get the books out? Do you work with small press distribution?
We distribute through SPD, and then they distribute to Amazon for us, because we used to do it directly with Amazon, but it was, you know, it ended up costing us $10 every time somehow. I don't know, like Amazon is evil. But the other interesting facet of this is that if you're a poet, it's sort of like being a musician. You're selling your tapes from the back of your car. Like, that's a big part of the kind of relationships we have with our poets, is they have to go out and sell their book. Like, it's not magic. Like, publication is not this magical validation in which people are going to say, oh, this person is a genius because she published a book, because there's hundreds of books in the world. But it's about people going out, reading their books, people getting excited about their books, buying their books. So, you know, at AWP or at readings, that's another big part of where people get our books. We sell a lot of books online too.
Yeah. Now, do you sell online directly yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And that means taking orders, processing the payment. Is it PayPal and whatever?
It was a disaster when I did it. It was a I woke up every morning with like intense anxiety about what I had not sent out.
Right.
So it's like,
it's a lot of work.
A lot of work.
You're packing individual orders to people going to the post office.
Yeah.
They get to know you really well at the post office.
Lupe.
Yeah. They see you coming. They don't ask. They don't ask anymore. Is this
exactly.
And you know, the question that you know, now they say, is there anything liquid, hazardous, or perishable? They already know that
exactly.
There isn't.
Well, and with the first few years that we did the contest, we would do paper submissions. And so, like, they'd see us walk in and they'd just, like, stack these, you know, these crates of manuscripts for us to read. But moving online was a pretty smart move for us.
For the reading,
and also because our staff was all over the place.
Right. Makes it a lot easier to send them around rather than physical copies.
Yeah.
Which we
would do around my kitchen table. You know, like, I picked Khadijah Queen's book in my house. Like, you know, like, my friend Richard Greenfield was helping us read, and it was just like this conversation. I miss that part of it. I miss that sort of, like, let's kind of talk, let's read to each other. But you know, I trust what they're doing. I trust who they're picking.
Well, and there's everything evolves and changes
exactly.
too. So, here's another question about selling books. Do individual writers, let's say you're a poet, you publish a book with Noemi, do most of them have their own websites, and then they would sell books on their own through their own sites? Does that ever happen?
I don't think so. I think mostly they'll send the people to the website, or they'll send them to SPD, or they'll buy 100 copies
and then sell them.
Yeah,
at the
and we also promote the books. We send out at least 50 review copies for each book, and we try to send them out like 4 months before, like, to make the Publishers Weekly date. And so recently we've been getting reviewed in Publishers Weekly, which has been very, very good for us.
And you're sending them physical copies
And well, publishers, we're sending physical copies to like The Believer and right. Salon and all of those different venues. But Publishers Weekly does everything electronically.
So you become more established in that way. You know, yeah. You have an identity.
Yeah, that's right.
And how many books have you published now? Have you kept track? Do you keep a number?
No, a lot.
Yeah. I gave the number last night. Oh, yeah, 60. I think it was 64.
64.
Yeah, that's a lot.
I went on your website. I didn't count, but I did notice that you have a whole lot of series.
Yes.
And a couple of them, I mean, I guess I wanted to ask just sort of, what does that mean? Does that reflect the, and now I think I understand better that it reflects maybe interests of people that are involved with Noemi.
Yes.
Not just your own interest.
Francisco Aragon, who is an angel and a saint, he proposed to me a few years ago that we partner. He works with Letras Latinas at Notre Dame, that we partner in producing a book of Latino poetry, kind of innovative Latino poetry every year. And so we created the Acrylica series. It's named after Juan Felipe Herrera's landmark book, Acrylica. And so that's one of the series that we have. And it's so awesome. I love that series. We really have a close editorial relationship with the people we publish. We work a lot with their books. And I think that's something else that I really admire about our editors is they're active editors. It's not like rubber stamp, we accepted your book, let's send it to the printers. They edit the books. They look at the books. We talk about order. Some of the books we edit for a year before we even agree to publish them. Because we want them to be as good as they can be, as opposed to like these books that you read and you're like, it's half baked. It could, you know, if someone would just have intervened a little bit, it would have been a much more solid book. We're really proud of that. Acrylica, we're publishing Latino writers, and we're publishing one or two books a year with Letras Latinas. So they help us fund the publication of the books and it gives it also, I think, people want to be published in the Acrylica series, which is kind of exciting for us, you know, because I thought it was going to be just this kind of thing that, you know, flew under the radar, but it's been something that people have been very responsive to. The other series that is very important to me and to J. Michael Martinez and to Diana Artarian is the Infidel Poetic series. That was one of the things that I wanted to do from the beginning, but I just had to wait for it to see how it was going to work out. The first Infidel Poetics book was by Sarah Vapp, The End of the Sentimental Journey. And my vision of that series was that it could be brief works of like innovative poetics, often hybrid. So they're beautiful and dense, and they're also like talking about poetry and aesthetics and art. And Sarah's book fit that perfectly. So we have this little square book. They're going to be designed by Douglas Kearney, and his is the second one in the series. It's called Mess and Mess End. We're going to have Roberto Tejada, Ariel Greenberg, and there's just going to be these little sexy square books, you know, that are going to kind of all look the same. And, you know, that's the design nerd in me. That's the thing I'm most excited about in a way, because I love design. And Douglas Kearney is an enormous, amazing designer.
So it sounds like for Noemi, you're not doing digital publishing.
We are. It's still cheaper because even if we have a huge order from.
Oh, I didn't mean digital printing. I meant that you wouldn't be switching to online.
Oh no.
That the physical object is important to you.
Yeah, the physical object is very important to me, and it's very important to the writers. And I don't think that the world has changed enough for an ebook to have that same cachet that a physical book has. But if I like physical books, and I think that you can write in them and you can engage with them. I mean, so often we're in conversation. I once heard someone say that you don't own a book until you write in it. And I like that. I like that sentiment.
Sometimes you feel like there's this beautiful book, and if you write in it, you might be ruining it.
That's right. That's right. Some texts are sacred.
Yeah, it's hard to know when to do that and not. But you do you print digitally, and that sounds like that's very useful to you.
Absolutely.
Will continue. But have you had books where you've needed to print offset because the quantities are too large?
I mean, we could have, but we don't know enough. Like, we don't know enough about how to anticipate what's going to happen to a book or who's going to need a book or how many books are going to sell. Some books will just be like, one day we had one book that it just came out, and on the first day it was out, we sold 80 copies online. It was completely crazy. We didn't expect that. So we're kind of learning more and more. My managing editor is a graduate student named Sarah Jemskin. She's a genius, and she's like so... She can, like, everything I throw at her, she can handle it, and she's on top of everything. And so she's more aware of, like, well, we should probably order this many of that book, and I expect that SPD is going to want these many of that book. And SPD's orders have, the number of books that they order from us have increased because we do sell a lot of books, so...
But it does. That's another challenge for being an independent publisher with a lot of titles. When you're printing digitally, you have to look at your inventory all the time.
That's right.
And your orders and say, wow, I need more books.
That's right.
And you have to order them so you don't run out.
Yeah. That's why they don't let me do that, because it would be a disaster.
Good with spreadsheets.
Exactly.
Yeah. So a couple more questions. One question, I guess, about... sort of, what's your vision for the future for, you know, not only Noemi, but how do you see independent publishing in the world today? You know, what its prospects and its, you know, it feels like there's a change going on. It's hard to pin down what it is when you're, but it feels like poetry, especially now, is becoming more engaged in the world,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking into what's around us, and publishing is part of that. You know, publishing is another expression of the desire to engage.
Yeah.
Do you feel that that's right?
Yeah, and those are the books that we try to publish. You know, we're very interested in humanity. I mean, I think one thing that we probably all have in common is some kind of interest in the lyric voice. I think that's probably one thing that could, you know, would define however that manifests itself. And I think that that people's critique of the lyric voice has been, you know, informed by a lot of these conversations that you're describing. And so I see that continuing to happen. And I also see this younger generation of writers being much braver than my generation of writers. And I'm very excited about that. In terms of Noemi Press, my goal is to not do it anymore. You know, my goal is to teach this staff to do it so I can walk away from it. Because I'm not Noemi Press. Like, the books and the staff are Noemi Press. And I want a group of younger people to take over it so it can, you know, maintains that freshness and that exciting energy. We publish like really surprising books. They're choosing really surprising books and exciting books. And it's clear to me that they know something that I don't know, and I'm completely willing to trust them. At a certain point, I'm planning on just not doing it anymore and saying, congratulations, birthed a publishing thing.
No, I think that's a powerful statement that you just made that really differentiates you from a lot of what I would call ego-driven publishers, you know, whose goal is to be somehow remembered for doing these great works.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really different approach to want to be remembered for bringing something into the world that other people can do. That's different.
Yeah, I mean, I think because they're excited and they just are smart and they have energy and they know what poetry needs to be doing. And I think that's always been what Noemi wanted to do, is to not just be publishing what people are doing, but also publishing what people should be doing and what people will be doing. And at a certain point, I'm going to lose touch with that. That's fine, you know. But I also feel like someone else needs to be able to, you know, control the overall vision of Noemi Press and let it be something else without me, and just to kind of give over the reins. I'm very... I'm looking forward to that. I'm
Is that something that you think is happening fairly soon, or
fairly soon? But it's definitely. The staff knows that that's sort of one of my long-term goals, and so you know, a lot of the operation stuff people are learning because, you know, I'm going to extricate myself at a certain point, and it just needs to continue running smoothly. And so I do less and less of the editorial decision making, so they have more and more ownership of it.
Oh, that's great. All right, one more question, and that is, and then people can ask questions from the audience, but of what publishers do you really look at and say, I love their work?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily who you aspire to be,
yeah.
Just who do you think out there, like if I said that somebody I might not have heard of, or maybe somebody it is, but just who's out there doing great work?
Action Books. I think Action Books does fantastic because they do so many translations. They do fantastic translations. They do really risky books. Coffeehouse is sort of, you know, to me, Coffeehouse is the big publisher, right? They publish amazing novels. They publish everything, and a lot of it is fantastic. And I also like see Coffeehouse as, you know, someone publishes with Noemi Press, maybe they can take that momentum and, you know, get published by Coffeehouse. That's the other way that I'm connected to Coffeehouse. Who else? I'm sort of drawing a blank here.
Well,
sorry.
Yeah, Two is good.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. And so, why don't we, if anybody in the audience wants to ask you a question, I think that would be great.
I was curious about Puerto del Sol and the connection to the university. A lot of us work on Queen City Review,
mm-hmm.
And I'm the incoming editor-in-chief, and you know, you said some things I found that were really interesting, like that you hired somebody, which was impressive.
To do a redesign.
You were able to hire somebody, or that you were able to sell online. So I'm just curious how are you tied to the department and what that relationship is like, and if it's been an easy one or a challenging one.
It's been a very easy one. And you know, the chair, I've had three chairs since I've been the editor, and I think they see the value in letting the students have this experience. And so it's never going to be a profitable venture. But when I took over, I did want to make it more profitable. I wanted to make it less expensive. And so I think that that's also been, and there are different ways to do that. Again, like doing small batches of printing, you know, finding people to design it, like finding it, you know, we had a graduate student in the art department just do some design, just to have the experience of designing. So creating partnerships, it's really a hustle, you know, and like the point of the hustle is trying to do it for the least amount of money and to generate the most amount of attention.
Are you, does the English department or the university subsidize?
It sure does, yeah.
It
subsidizes course releases for me, and it gives us money. And that, you know, that money is now that we're going online, that number is going to go down, but that's again sort of the goal of, you know, I'm not going to say out loud what I'm thinking, because then my department will do something. But you know what I'm thinking.
It's just interesting, even just with you know, your website and things, like we've had a lot of challenges with that, dealing with, not the English department is amazing, they've supported us, and the LNS, you know, they recognize our value, but you know, we've run into problems just dealing with the university system and our wonderful leadership as far as the state goes.
I think we're also kind of flying under the radar, like I think that we're getting checks from, you know, from distributing companies. They're happy with that. Like, we're not, and we're able to actually do more for the students because we have this extra income coming in that wasn't necessarily coming in before. Before, with the distributor, we were paying the distributor. And so now we're not doing that.
Because they were, because they would take copies and then send back unsold copies, and it's a net loss.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you do like Project Muse or anything like that? I know you said you have like an ebook situation.
No, I wish I could remember. I'm just not good with names. Featherweight. Is it Featherweight? I don't remember. I'll look it up and I'll look it up and let Brenda know. But they specialize in really small magazines, and we don't sell tons. I don't think we sell that many at all. But again,
so they sell the digital copy.
They sell the digital copy.
They're the platform, and they take this. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I think EBSCO does that for some magazines.
Yeah.
And Overdrive also.
Yeah, we do distribute through EBSCO, right. But you know that they just do little small. Yeah. Orders from us.
They already are on Project Muse.
But Project Muse is sort of like the database.
Articles,
deals with universities. But you know, we were looking to like a Lit Ragger, which I don't even know if they're around anymore, or something like what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Book.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that we did that was useful was making some content available online. Because then it was kind of like teasers. We make all the reviews available online because, you know, the point of a review is to promote the work. And that's gotten a lot of traffic for us. But making little pieces, we just kind of modeled ourselves. We looked at all of the online magazines and just kind of modeled ourselves at the different ways that they used the platform.
Anybody else? Well, yes, I didn't see your hand.
Yeah,
much better.
Thank you for everything and for letting us listen to your conversation. I have a question. It's a yes or no question.
Okay.
You were talking about soliciting work from your heroes and the excitement of the 50th anniversary and well, we're coming up with our 40th, and I was wondering if you would read something. Because I have one here on my phone. It's called Migraine.
I can if you want me to.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just wanted to hear you read it.
Okay. I don't have it though.
Okay. It's digital. That's fine. Thanks.
Can I make that bigger?
Yeah.
Even I could see that was small.
Yeah. Okay, I'll just read it. It's called Migraine. Títere. Títere y título, títere, sans título, the tring, tring, tring of Tylenol, sans codeine, tattered tripas and tripping balls on pain, títere, in situ, and extremis, tres turnos chiflados, the thrum of cartoons burned into theories about my tender, heretofore era, opening a drawer, grating torrents of distemper, mothers in bed otra vez, vete, even the tumult of breath, too much or too vampiric. Títere en la falda, títere doblada, trundled in the tower away from the tatter of thinking or trying or even light.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Well, the perfect way to end on
Hopefully it won't give you a migraine.
Or I would take one away.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for doing
thank
this.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
And thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Will be posted on the writerscast.com podcast site. Sometime in the next month. I hope you'll all visit writerscast.com and listen to some of the interviews there.
Okay.
Thank you.
This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I've had the great pleasure of talking to Carmen Jimenez-Smith of Puerto del Sol and Noemi Press.